Inside Lacrosse Podcasts, the source of the sport.
What's up, guys? Terry Foy here at Inside Lacrosse Headquarters. We are talking about the top 50 players for 2025, joined by Kevin Brown, Matt Kinnear, Dan Kaplan. Happy to be here. Let's get it going.
Thanksgiving week, we always do this. Looking ahead to the season, we're only a few months away from college lacrosse. You guys have all sent me your top 50 lists. You don't know each other's. I have mine as well. So we're going to talk about what we each have, what's different, what's the same. And I think we all, and I think most people who follow college lacrosse are in agreement about who the best player in college lacrosse is. Just to be clear, there's really no marching orders for how you want to do this list. Is it projected? Is it based on what you thought of last year? What do you do about guys who have injuries? You know, how much do you take into account what you saw in fall ball? It's kind of a blank slate for everyone to kind of make their own interpretation of what is the top 50 players. But everyone agrees CJ Kirst Cornell is the number one player in college lacrosse. Dan, I know that you have been, you've seen Cornell at least this fall. CJ Kirst, why is he the unanimous number one player in college lacrosse?
Yeah, I think he's the most dynamic player, and Cornell's in a position to have one of the best offensives in the country, in a position to have a great season, and it's a lot going to be on his shoulders. But I think when it comes to him and scouting him and looking at his game, like, he is so dynamic on the lefty wing, but is versatile. You can put him anywhere in any spot. And I feel like just in big moments, he's always composed, and he just has that it factor heading into this season that, you know, I think unanimously here, but I also think that he's pretty well seen as the number one pick in the PLL draft impending as well.
It's the it factor that I want to pick up on, because I got an opportunity to be around him this past summer in a way that was a little different from just watching him play for Cornell. He was with Team USA for their Sixes training camp, and I got to go watch film with that group after they concluded their multi-day practice sessions. And you could tell, I mean, it was a group with, let's call it 25 alphas, some of whom, most of whom were in the pros already, and some of whom were still in college. And CJ exudes a characteristic that I think now is pretty common among the Kirsts. It's this, like, energy, this enthusiasm, this happiness, this joyfulness that I think is very contagious. But it wasn't just that. It's also about how inquisitive he is, how cerebrally he thinks about the game, and how willing he is to be a teammate. It's not simply about trying to get his own, and I thought that that was what I came away most impressed by in that interaction.
Yeah, his numbers were a little down from his 2023 season. 20 less goals, around the same assist, three more than that 2023 season. They miss out in the playoffs, third most efficient offense still, and he's going to have a chip on his shoulder to make sure he's still the best player in the country without that the handful of players who graduated in that generational PLL draft.
And he's got his 1-2 punch there with the Big Red, and we're going to get to his kind of running mate and a few other guys on this list here as we go along. Also, a summer playing box. CJ's played a little bit of box throughout his years. That can only bode well for what he does this spring at Cornell. Now, you know, it's interesting. We all had a consensus number one guy, but it's kind of a sea change in college lacrosse generally this year. You know, when we did this, it was so for years, you know, Brendan O'Neill, Pat Cavanaugh, Connor Schellenberger kind of dominated the conversation about college lacrosse. You know, CJ's the guy that's left of that group in terms of, you know, that this is the cream of the crop, the number one. From there, you know, we don't really have a ton of agreement. Two of us have the same guy as the number two player in the country. Two different, Notre Dame is represented twice here, though, but different guys. So I'm going to go to Terry, because you have been banging the drum harder than anybody else about this player. Sean Light is your number two player in college lacrosse heading into this season.
Yeah, you didn't know that?
No.
Oh. Yeah, that's. I think that's my hottest take of all. You know, where this falls, high or low. I had Ben Ramsey number seven last year. I think that proved to be a little aggressive. I don't. That this might end up looking similarly, but I think there's a little bit more built in. Again, came away from watching him play in a different context this time at the U20 tryouts, and he was, in my opinion, so clearly the best player there. That it bolstered what was if you probably had just looked at the second half of Notre Dame's season, I think he would have been a first-team All-American. And when you account for the freshman to sophomore leap, you know, he knows how to train for Notre Dame, right? He knows what playing college lacrosse is going to be like. You skim off that top layer of players that he has to cover, and the likelihood that he dominates matchups jumps forward even farther faster. So this is a future bet as opposed to the guy who I think was maybe the second best player in college lacrosse last year, but a guy who we're going to get to see Sean Light cover CJ Kirst, right? They played one of the most epic games last year. I hope they're on the schedule again this year. So that's my pick for number two. Who else had? Nobody? Or did you?
At number two, no. Okay. Two of us, myself and Kevin, had Chris Kavanaugh at number two. But Sean Light, I want to talk about him more because I think that's the big theme, at least to me in my list, is this sophomore leap. I have a lot of guys who, you know, weren't first, second team All-Americans in the end of the year list, but were freshmen last year and played really well. And I'm just banking on them taking an enormous leap in their sophomore year, particularly with this great group of seniors that just graduated, having more responsibility, having more headlines, having all that. Sean Light is certainly at the top of the list. I have him as my fourth player on my top 50 list. And Dan Kaplan, you have him at number three.
Yeah.
So he's consensus top five player for sure. But you know, no one is as high on them as you. But let me just throw this out there. Connor Schellenberger, he held him scoreless in the ACC semifinal. Duke's Andrew McIndory held him scoreless. Joey Spallina held him to 1 point. Let's see, Eric Spanos, he was on him in the national title game. So he's played the best of the best and has done his job as a freshman. So who knows what the sophomore year holds for him. Maybe it's going to be the Smizer Award. Chris Kavanaugh. You know I had him at my second best player. I was higher than him going into last year. It was a much discussed ranking, him in his top 50, going from, you know, later in the list in the top 50s last year to
37 to be exact.
37th to national championship, most outstanding player at the end of the year. Kevin, why do you have him at number two?
Just for the jump in facilitating, and his passing game really excelled last year. The biggest, the most funny reason why his older brother Pat, the reigning Torton winner, was griping with us for that ranking. He's like, guys, you can see he can do it. He's a great passer this year. Like, he really took that leap. That is exactly why we had him a little lower on the list last year. We weren't sure we'd see that leap yet. So now that we've seen it, I've got him solid in as my number two player for the 2025 season. And it'll be interesting. I think for your theme of freshmen to sophomores, a really impactful freshman class last year, there's a good handful of guys who will graduate from being the number two option for some offenses to the number one option. And Chris Kavanaugh, all attention is going to be on him come next season.
Totally. And we've seen in the same remark you made about the Kirst family, you know, the Kavanaugh family, the way they improve throughout their career and, you know, the way that they rise to the occasion when they are the number one person, you know, when they need to be relied on in the biggest moment. Clearly, they do it. You know, they execute every time. So,
and he was arguably number one guy for large stretches of the first half of the season. Pat, remember, he was coming back from some injuries from the 23 title-winning season. Chris steps up. He ends up with 37 assists, up from whatever he had in 23. But just a really solid season from him, and I think he's only going to continue to rise.
I want to stay in the ACC here. Dan, you have some of the outliers in this list, and I love it. You have Andrew McIndory as your number two player in the country heading in the 2025 season. You know, he's certainly up there in a lot of our lists. I don't think anyone else has him in the top 10, though. Why are you so much higher on McIndory than everybody else?
Yeah, I think that it's similar to that concept of, like, room to grow. Who in the country has more room to shoulder a larger load than Andrew in terms of what graduated, you know, last year in Brendan O'Neill.
While also having the track record of having maybe not been guarded by number ones, but been guarded by the best possible option 2 years ago when he was being flanked by Williams and O'Neill.
Certainly. And then furthermore, like, I think that if you were to make an argument against him, it's not necessarily ability, it's how and where and when, right? It's he's an incredible attackman, but if you play him at midfield, he's probably the best midfield quarterback in the country. But he's somebody that's so valuable at attack and transition, being a decision maker and doing all sorts of things for an offense that maybe don't show up in stat lines. And I think it's probably a bit of a investment into what he could be this year, further than what other lists have. But I feel really good about it, especially when you consider skill set, ability, and then that room to grow. And who's to say that this fall, when they got on campus, there wasn't a conversation similar to this where they gave him the keys and said, like, let's do this thing. You know, I don't know that, but it wouldn't shock me to find that out. And then him to play with a ton of confidence and really take ownership as the alpha of that team.
Yeah, the guy can flat out ball. Speed is just speed galore for him. Vision, yeah, he had 9 assists last year playing up top, coming out of the box. 36 goals, 25 assists when he was back at that attack position. I would push back a little bit being guarded by the best player when he's...
No, I know, that's what I'm saying. He wasn't guarded by number ones, but relative... Yeah. He's not a midfielder making the transition to attack for the first time.
Exactly.
He has been guarded by ACC defenders previously in his career, and there is less question about his transition into that role than there would be for a lot of guys who didn't have the similar type of experience 2 years ago.
So his movement in our top 50 list, just being the guy who does some of the social rollout the last few years, just he's gone from the 12th best for the 24 season when he was in that attack position. I think he was around Chris Kavanaugh's like 37-40 range when he was playing midfield last year coming into this past season. So I have him just outside the top 10, and I think, it's tough, I think, to argue that he's already better than Chris Kavanaugh after seeing the most outstanding player in the tournament performance he put forth, the creativity he plays with, the passing. Just he definitely doesn't have McAdoy's athleticism, but interesting that you have him over Kavanaugh.
You could also make that same argument, though, about being guarded by ones with Chris.
No doubt.
Right?
Like that was kind of what I was implying.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right. And I lied. I had him at number 7. So you weren't the only person within the top 10. Only person within the top 5, though. So here, Joey Spallina, I have at number 3 in the country. Kevin, you have Spallina at number 5. Dan, you have him at number 8. Terry, you have him at number 6. So we're kind of all in the same ballpark about where we think Joey Spallina falls. Terry, with him, you know, what's the difference between him at number 6 versus number 2, number 3? What's he got to do there?
Well, I mean, I think, as is typically the case in these types of rankings, it's Sean Lake, Holter Magazine, Chris Kavanaugh, and Emma Carroll. Like, those are the guys that I have ahead of him. So I think that in order for Syracuse... In order for Joey to, in my opinion, be the justifiable second, third pick in this type of list, like, they would have had to have beaten Denver, advanced the Final Four, and that probably would have been enough to say, all right, the quarterback on a Final Four team coming back, the team bringing back more than pretty much anybody else, justifies that position. As it is, I think just slightly outside of that is where I settle out. Point being, doesn't really have that much to do with him at all, right? Either his production, his profile and performances. Surely you would like to see a little bit more shooting accuracy in the biggest games, but I'm not going to ding him for that relative to, you know, the ability to dominate and take over. So I think that it's kind of, you know, we see this all the time in pro sports where a team falls short of their postseason goals and then they have to play the entire next regular season Ravens are in this situation. You know, there are a lot of NBA teams that are in this situation. It's like nothing matters until we get back to the point where we're going to be evaluated and judged by.
Yeah, and, you know, I have him at number three, but I agree that like he needs his moment. He needs his tour time moment. He needs his big, like, you know, NCAA tournament, going to take a team on his back.
Because he's done everything short of that.
Yeah, that's the next step for him. I kind of lean on the fact that, yes, Syracuse has more returning than most teams that we have on this list outside of Notre Dame. I would, you know, they're our number one in the way ahead rankings that we did earlier this in the fall. So he's going to have that moment. You know, that's the big test.
He's such a sure thing too.
Yeah,
such a big jump in production. 20 more points in his freshman campaign. Just, you know, he's going to continue to increase his productivity. Another great summer and playing box up in Canada there. So just like you said, we know what you're going to get out of Joey Spolino. And from the post-ups, from the facilitating, from can he gain maybe an even quicker first step to draw more slides and everything of that nature, it'll be interesting. Like, pre-show, not to jump to the next guy if you wanted to finish your Spolino thought, but I'm interested to get everyone's Colter Mackesy thoughts, because he's a guy where you saw the 78 points from his breakout sophomore campaign, and then Nate Kiberi comes in and he selflessly takes a step back and he's like, hey, you're going to get your touches over on the opposite wing and I'm still going to get mine, and I'm still going to be one of the most elusive, slickest lefty marksmen in the country.
I said this before we started recording that he was the most difficult of like the top end guys. He was the most difficult guy for me to place where he goes because of the Kiberi effect. You know, is Kiberi a top 10 player heading this year? Or is Mackesy a top 10 player heading this year? Or are they both? You know, like, I'm really high on Princeton. I think I had Princeton higher than Syracuse when we did our way ahead rankings. So I don't know. I mean, I kind of settled him at 9 or 10, you know, in this draft of the list here. But I could put him back down at, you know, 16 and move Kiberi up there too. I'm really not sure. But there is something to be said about, you know, the guy, he carried that offense a little bit, and then when the guy who, you know, the great kind of fluid ex-attackman comes in, you know, it unleashes him to maybe not have the same point productivity, but to be a more effective player overall.
Can I reveal my number three player?
Yes.
Real quick.
Well, this is another outlier. So that's what, you know, in terms of, I think one other person had this player in their top 10 of the list.
Yeah.
You just love the troops. Evan Plunkett.
Just
Army, number three.
One of the best passing midfielders I've seen in the last however many years, you want to say. Like, as a plebe, 25 assists, a little down from that last year when he had 19, 29 goals. Just he draws slides at will. And his ability last year just to see through defenses, I think he had a lot more second assist, a lot more hockey assist that we don't track, or maybe in the future. I just love his game. Not many players I would put ahead of him. I've got him as the third best player. Yeah. Just yeah, only two, exactly. So just his athleticism, his skill, his stick skills, his shooting. He's got the total package for me.
I don't disagree with anything you said qualitatively about him, but quantitatively, I have him as my third best midfielder. So I have him behind Ben Johnston, who I have number eight
Wow.
overall. And that was a function of when we recorded a similar conversation about the, you know, projecting the top 10 teams, and I talked about the leap he was going to need to make.
Yeah.
I heard from a couple folks who had seen the Blue Devils practice in the fall, and they were like, that clip is going to age very well on the basis of how dominant he had been in Durham. You know, we didn't see him compete against anybody else other than the Blue Devils.
Totally.
We didn't see it.
But that's projection. You're saying he's already better than Evan Plunkett?
No, I'm saying that he will be over the course of the 25 season. And then the other guy, who I think if you were to evaluate them side by side in 2024, I think it was actually pretty difficult. It was more of a suggestion of what it is that you value. But I've got Mikey Whitechire at number, 11 overall? Mm-hmm. Yeah, two spots ahead of Plunkett, who I have at 13.
Yeah, he's so fun. And just the...
Is he fun to watch?
He's pretty fun to watch. I'm surprised you have him over guys like Sam English, just a do-it-all midfielder kind of guy. He's my second midfielder. And maybe this is sort of the way we should structure some of this conversation, and just positional rankings are kind of so enticing to consider when you put all this together. It's like, okay, where do they all categorize? But anyway,
That's how I did it. I made my list by position.
Right.
And then I kind of, you know, went from there and you know, I had my number one attackman, my number one midfielder. That's kind of how we've done a lot of the recruiting stuff as well.
Yeah.
That's just kind of the formula that's worked for me.
Ben Johnson, I think, will get to that area, that aura, maybe in his junior year, maybe in 26. I'm not giving it to him quite yet.
Do you have him in the 50 at all?
I don't have him in my 50, mostly because he slid out of the rotation the last four not out of the rotation, but the first line midfield the last four games of the season. So just doing the freshman rankings, I kind of took that and hindered him a little bit in my rankings. But
well, the thing is, one of you is going to have a clip that is going to age very well, and one of you is going to have a clip that ages very poorly.
What's your take?
I have him somewhere in the middle of both of you, where he's closer to like the 40 range.
Where do you have Plunkett?
At 10.
Okay.
And I have Weishauer at 9. So right in that same mix. But
yeah. Weishauer, yeah, I have at number 8, and I have
Plunkett's
at 13.
Strength. Weishauer is so speedy, and he's basically an attack.
The thing about him is
I'm very sensitive to that.
Yeah, he's same. But more importantly, I think he's just the heartbeat of that team. Like if you like I caught that Towson Hopkins game in person, and he did so much in that game, and it just felt like he like more than what he actually provided on the field, like he gave like an element of emotion and energy that is irreplaceable.
And I wouldn't necessarily say that Evan Plunkett doesn't bring something very similar.
Sure.
But it's Army. Like, everybody on the roster brings a lot of that.
Yeah.
To the point about he's basically an attackman, I mean, I think that's probably true for any midfielder who puts up a lot of points. The question is, they have to – I mean, so my point of view on are you actually a midfielder is, are there three guys who are more solidly attackmen on your team than you? And if the answer is yes, then you are a midfielder almost by default. And that is, in my opinion, the case for both of those guys.
Well, without Nick DeMeo, I think there's a clear hole for him to fill in this season for Towson. But
in which case, you would want to see his production jump by 20 to 30% by virtue of not taking, you know, every second or two out of every three runs, but by being on the field all the time.
Precisely.
Emmett Carroll. He's a guy that a lot of us had really high on our list. I had him at number 5. Kaplan, you had him at number 4. Terry, you had him at number
5
as well.
I think he's the one that's highest on him out of all of us.
Yeah. And I had him at 10.
Yeah.
I guess how you value he was not my number one goalie. I think he's the best goalie in the country. You know, I think I had a list of about 7 goalies that I considered in this list. He was, you know, my clear number one. Nothing was going to change my mind. And again, I've said this before, but the way that he stops high percentage shots changes the way that Penn can play defense in a way that no other goalie affects. You know, there's obviously goalies that are solid all around and incredible goalies, but he, you know, his presence changes the entire way that Penn plays. So I have him at number 5, which I think last year he was heartily underrated heading into the year. I think he kind of became appropriately rated as the season went on. But number 5 is quite a leap from last year for Emmett Carroll.
Leading the country in save percentage will do that, right?
Yeah.
Throughout the season, he had a sizable gap over Entman, and then Entman started growing into the season, and that shrunk. But just like you said, the way that impacts the Quakers' defense, and for my money, I think the biggest rival to Sean Light's ascent to that Schmeisser leading candidate is Brendan Lavelle. All the physical attributes that he brings to the game at close defense. It's all a matchup against Brennan O'Neill in that Durham upset last season, if you call it an upset. He's got the total package. And when you consider the rest of that Quakers defense, it's like he's an eraser. Emma Carroll's the best goalie in the nation. You're in a good spot.
McCabe Millen is probably the consensus guy that we haven't really talked about. And consensus isn't even the right word. Three of us had him in our top 10. And actually, no, two of us did. You and me.
Nice.
McCabe, another one of these guys that, again, it's the theme that we keep going back to of there's a hole to fill now. Someone's got to step up. McCabe Millen is probably example, you know, number one or number two when you talk about the impact that Connor Schellenberger has had on that program. Not just from his production, which obviously has been incredible, but just, you know, Connor Schellenberger, I think, was the heartbeat of Virginia lacrosse for a long time. Now, McCabe has got to take on that role. Dan, what makes you think that he can do that?
Yeah, so, I mean, we've seen him shoulder it, obviously, at the high school level and coming in with a ton of prestige. But then he came in as a freshman, and there seemed to be, like, you know, a lot of, I would say, anxiety about how he would perform, right? And then he came in and really lived up to the bell. He had a ton of points and performed exceptionally. And I think what was the most interesting about it was how he performed in big moments, right? Like, there were lots of situations where, obviously, Schellenberger was going to be trusted and given the keys in the clutches of times. But there were a lot of times where that wasn't the best matchup to go to because McCabe over the second choice was legitimately a better option, right? And so with that gap in mind and then the freshman year going into that sophomore, you know, jump, hopefully avoiding that slump, sophomore slump that we were talking about a little bit earlier in that, you know, going back and forth on those two ideas, right? If he avoids that and he takes the sophomore bump, right, and he's able to go ahead and, you know, continue to assert himself, then we're going to be looking at one of the best quarterbacks for one of the best offenses and one of the best teams in the country.
That's the perfect point spot for me to pick up on. I had him at 20th, and I'll probably end up just looking at it again in more of the 15-ish range. But in the same way that the conversation about Joey Spolina not being top five is less about Joey Spolina and more about what Syracuse has accomplished, my criticism of McCabe's ceiling is less about McCabe the player and more about Virginia as an offense. I'm not super confident that they're definitely going to be a top 10 offense. I'm not
super.
Well,
they will if he's what we're saying that he is.
I disagree. He could be what he was last year from a production standpoint, and I don't know that he's necessarily throwing the ball to guys that are putting it into the back of the net as efficiently as Peyton Cormier did to the extent that they can get to the level that they got to last year. Maybe they can. I'm certainly not trying to argue that it can't happen.
Yeah.
I'm saying that is the concern. That is my caution. That's just, you know, kind of separating that 5 to 10 spots.
Yeah. And if you look at my list, like, my list is pretty heavily shaded towards that QB type, that, like, mm-hmm. ball carrying, ball decision making, you know, going to shoulder the load in big moments type of players.
Talk about some guys that we had in, you know, each of us had in our top 10 list that we haven't discussed yet. Kevin, Levi Virch.
Whoa!
Wow. In the top 10?
I recently took him out. this is the first draft, folks. But I still have him very close to that top 10 range. Hovering around 13 right now. 80 ground balls. That's sort of an overcompensation, maybe, ranking him this high after, I think, really devaluing Mason Woodward the last few years and seeing what the impact, of course it's not the same, the impact he had his rookie season for the Archers was phenomenal. I think Levi Virch is in that very same mold. 80 ground balls and 29 calls turnovers, just a do-it-all type of player. You can control the middle of the field and take it in transition himself, so he's really skilled in.
To be clear, the laughing wasn't at you having him in the top 10.
Correct. No.
It was
me changing my mind immediately upon getting called upon.
Correct, yes.
Worth the chirps. I think it's interesting to consider the polls around him. Will Donovan is my favorite LSM going into next season. I have him a couple spots ahead. And you look at, like, he doesn't put up gaudy numbers. 21 calls turnovers, 33 ground balls. Just, he's a lockdown eraser for whoever you want to shut down in that top midfield unit when the bevy of challengers that Notre Dame plays in season.
And that's what I wanted to transition to, because Terry, you had Will Donovan as a top 10 guy. And I don't know, like, somehow he flew under the radar. I don't know. Like, I feel like being the LSM for the two-time national champions means you should kind of get more headlines than you do, but I don't know, for some reason he didn't.
Because he doesn't score as much.
He's a flashy player.
He doesn't do all the transition things that a Jake Paisano did last season, but he goes unnoticed when he fills the lane and is on that two slide right on time to shut down the crease.
Off the wing.
Yeah. I think that's when he shines the most.
I do, too. I think that's where I feel his presence is.
But
off the wing.
If I were to be concerned at all about whether or not he lives up to this billing, again, it's less about his ability and it's more about the opportunity set that comes with Greg Campisi's arrival. Mm-hmm. And one of them is either going to play close defense or is going to get fewer runs than he probably did last year or would have expected to. I think one of them is going to play close defense, and I think it's going to be Campisi. And so as a result, I think the question is, how good is Greg Campisi, the close defenseman, relative to Greg Campisi, Harvard's LSM? And then by virtue of that, does that just mean that whatever we would expect from Will Donovan is what's going to be produced?
Mm-hmm. The only other guy in our top tens was faceoff guy, Will Colletti for Army. I think probably we all have a consensus number one faceoff guy returning in the country. I do think that, you know, there's not quite the, like, Sisselberger level face-off impact that we're going to see this year. I'm also curious how, you know, I saw in some fall practices some guys were struggling a little bit with the, you know, the new mechanic there of the face-off, at least just like getting used to it. I don't think it's going to be a struggle that persists into the spring, so I'm curious how that position might change a little bit.
It's just all about how it's refereed. If it's refereed consistently, the players will be consistently through it. But
I do have another guy in my top 10 that we haven't talked about yet.
Oh, yes, Sam King.
Yeah.
Sam.
So, probably is that the Levi Verge switch?
No, he was in the top 10, but Ben Ramsey did sneak in there.
Got it.
Okay.
So, yeah, Sam King. I mean, I think elite production for a team that didn't make the NCAA tournament, didn't make the Ivy League tournament, but ultimately, that puts him into a category that's, like, not that different from C.J. Kerr. You know what I mean? Like, there's just a lot of really good offensive players that we can talk about. And to your point, Dan, about valuing QB attackmen, like, there's a reason that midfielders get moved to QBs like Andrew McIndory. It's because it's the most important role, and you put your best lacrosse player there. And so it makes sense that the – you know, a top 50 players list would over-index on those guys. And for me, you know, Sam King is a little bit of a less conventional QB in terms of how he likes to score. And I do feel like he benefited from the emergence of two attackmen flanking him that were really good. But I also think that some of his production might have been hampered a little bit, you know, because of the injuries they had at the midfield, and they have some guys coming back. So I think that, we couldn't have let the conversation of the top 10 go without bringing up.
Yeah, really balanced scorer. 38 goals, 35 assists. Yeah. So maybe surprising to see when you see all those jump shots coming up from end line restarts. He's also got some good passing in his game, too. Second in points per game last year.
Yeah, Teddy Malone was who I was primarily referring to in terms of the emergence that he made last year.
When you look at our list that we have, and I have them all in front of me, and you guys haven't seen each other's lists, but this really becomes the Ivy League attackman segment of the top 50. You know, you've got whatever combination that you perceive them in. You got Michael Long, you've got Nate Kabiri, you've got Chris Lyons returning for Yale, you've got Leo Johnson returning for Yale, you've got Sam King, as we mentioned, all kind of like in this area of the mix. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if this is player centric, but like, are we gonna like, how exciting is the Ivy League gonna be this year? And just like, Cap, I'll turn it over to you. Just like, when you look at the offensive groups as a whole, like, what just sticks out to you from the top Ivy League?
Yeah, it's going to be tough to keep goals off the board in that league this year. There's a lot of firepower on offense. I think that especially in one thing that you guys mentioned, I have them a little bit lower on my list. That's the two guys returning from injury for Yale. I have them at 43 and 48.
Oh,
but,
wow. But
mostly as a result of the, you know, we didn't see him last year, right? And so I certainly could see them climbing. And if those two guys climb, then my list would be looking at, like, 10 Ivy League attackmen between the ranks of 10 and 30, which would be, you know, pretty phenomenal.
Yeah. I kind of stratified a little bit on the basis of program, and so I'm particularly high on Lyons. I have him at 16. I think that he can get his own as well as anybody in the sport. And you and I've had this conversation a few times in terms of, you know, the role development that Yale attackmen go through, and we've seen this for literally 15 years, right? In terms of, you know, having a narrower role as freshmen and sophomores, as there's an upperclassman who is a quarterback.
Being the off-ball finisher to Brandow.
Correct. And I expect Johnson will remain the primary facilitator, but I do think we're going to see an unlock with respect to Lyons passing and his assist production, and I think that that's going to put him into that, you know, potential 100-point type of player category. I've got Long and Leo a little lower, kind of down in the range that you were talking about, not in the 40s, but in the high 30s. You know, Long, for me, the concern comes down to basically Ryan Goldstein and Willem Firth stealing a little bit of that production, as well as, you know, the injury history that he has. So, but, I mean, just an absolutely unbelievable player and something that should give Big Red fans a ton of peace.
Yeah. 5 points per game last season when he was healthy. So when it was on the field, he was producing. And it's just interesting to hear you guys stratify the different attackmen, like the sophomores this season coming into. I put Leo Johnson ahead of them, ahead of the McCabe, Owen Duffy's of the world.
Where did because you put Duffy? Have we talked about him?
No,
we have
not.
I have him 23 after McCabe 22 and Leo Johnson 21. Again, first draft. So this will come together in the compiled, aggregated top 50 list here. But Leo Johnson, just like you said, the facilitating that he had, every touch, I saw him in the fall. And,
that's right, you saw him.
Against North Carolina. Yeah. So every touch he had was gold. He had about 9 points in 3 quarters. So just he is one of my favorite players, just to watch him manipulate defenses and pass through them. So just him coming back from injury is going to be interesting. When you compare him against McCabe and Owen Duffy, another year of training that athletic horse that we know he is. And
well, wait. He's also coming back from injury.
Correct.
And he actually didn't play in the Carolina-Yale game that you went to.
Yeah.
So there's an argument to be made that Leo is farther ahead from an injury recovery standpoint than Duffy is.
Totally.
With the Ivy League, though, I think if we do this list at the end of this year, there's going to be a player who, you know, we don't talk about in the top 25 or so that will be in there. You know, when you think of like guys like Willem Firth, when you think of guys like Ryan Goldstein, you know, when you think of like a Tucker Wade, like it just feels like there's so many guys in the Ivy League that are ready to break out that it's going to be just a really interesting.
Well, there are two teams that could very realistically break out in Brown and Dartmouth, and I don't know that there's a Bear or a Big Green on any of our lists.
Right.
So yeah, there's no question that that's true. And not only that, I mean, we've talked a fair amount about Penn already, but we haven't talked about a Penn offensive player, and they're going to score goals. So, you know.
Yeah, where's Cam Rubin going to end up on this at the end of the year? You know, I think
48.
Right around that range, I think, is appropriate. I'm interested to see where you guys have Jake Taylor. I have him 19th, so right above those guys. Just he's such a finisher, so it's against
him 21st.
It's against your quarterback type, but he's just a winner. He's an off-ball savant, and the creativity he plays with, everything he does for that Notre Dame offense in terms of they can just jam it into him whenever they want, it opens up so much for how athletic all of their Dodgers are. So he's so important, and how much lower do you have?
I'm joking with you guys. I'm joking. I have him at 35th, so okay. He's not too much of a skid, but No, and a lot for what you were talking about. The way that everybody plays defense now, if you don't have to guard the crease, you can stay extended on the perimeter and not have to worry about sloughing too much. It totally changes the way that you play defense when you have to play Notre Dame and you're constantly having to help inside and constantly having to locate him. And a lot of times what teams will do is just elect not to slide off of him completely. And so if you put him inside, now you're forcing a team to have to slide adjacent. and nobody's as good sliding adjacent as they are sliding from the crease, because you've been sliding from the crease since you were 4 years old. You haven't been sliding adjacent at the speed in which you need to rotate.
Especially with somebody in the middle, right? Exactly. Where he's doing everything, mucking it up, and if he, setting the best picks in college lacrosse, and like making it so hard for the goalie to see the ball, and all this other stuff that's so hidden. I mean, basically, I don't want to interrupt, but if you like winning games, you should have Jake Taylor really high, and if you don't like winning games, then you should have him really low.
Yeah,
because that's what happens. When he plays, Notre Dame wins, and when he doesn't, it's kind of a toss-up.
Yeah.
Maybe not toss it.
What do you mean? They literally, they're like 500 without him.
Well, I think there's
other
factors.
They were 2-4 before.
I'm agreeing with you. I just think you went a little too far.
I think I was mathematically completely correct.
Math doesn't have any place in this.
You have done a tremendous service, by the way, bringing the stats with you to the conversation, because I was not that prepared.
Yeah, usually you're that guy, so I'm glad to take the mantle, but. Never again.
Well, let's move on to some defenders. Now, Scott Smith is a guy that I don't, you know, I still think a lot of people don't realize that he's coming back to Johns Hopkins. We all had him kind of in the same, you know, 11 through 20 range, 11 through 15 range. So he's back. A guy that I want to talk about, because we talked about the sophomore leap a little bit, and we talked about McCabe Millen. Ty Banks, I had him at number 13. Which is much higher than everyone else. There's some recency bias because I saw their scrimmage with Georgetown and Virginia, and he was the best player on the field. And, you know, he did a really good job on McCabe Millen for, you know, the three quarters or so that they had.
I'll pick that up right there. I think that that's – I actually – when I go back and relook at this, I think he's going to move up in mine. I have him at 28th and, like, the fifth defender. But what I think is the most interesting about him is – even just looking at last season, his first game compared to his last game were night and day. Mm-hmm. Even just almost his first game to his second game.
I mean, yes.
Were night and day.
Yeah, exactly. Shout out Evan James.
And assuming that that trajectory continues, like the rate of progress for him, I could certainly see him finishing at the end of this season as, you know, one of the top, a first team All-American.
Can I just mention a few guys who I think you may be undervaluing as a result of having him that high?
Okay.
Is Big East Defender of the Year, Jimmy Freehill. Great frame. Was covering some of the quickest attack in the round, which was really impressive. AJ Pilot, back-to-back Patriot League Defenseman of the Year. And we talked about Virch and Lavelle, and you brought up Scott Smith. But Billy Dwan is just an all-around menace around the field. So I'm interested. It's just fascinating that you have Banks that high relative to some of those other peers.
Yeah, for sure. And I think that there's a big part of that that is the, you know, I have direct evidence by seeing him in the fall, you know, up close and what he did against Millen. I have Dwan at 22. And some more guys that you didn't mention of that, you know, Colin Molshine, Pace Billings. I think it's an interesting year for defense because I think I kind of flipped the All-Americans a lot in what my, you know, the All-Americans from last year in what my list was. I think I had like a lot of like the honorable mention and third team guys as my like top few, and then those guys who were like first team, second team, I had as that next crew over. I think that, you know, when you talk about this young player developing in, you know, the Sean Light and the Ty Banks, I put a lot of value into that of their second or third year, you know, with added responsibility, kind of giving them a greater rate of improvement than the guys who have been there for 3 or 4 years.
Before we move off of defensemen, a couple guys that I want to bring up are Alex Ross, who I think is really responsible for Penn State's defensive cohesion. I do think that it would be hard to talk about Penn State's defense without mentioning Jack Grassion, who is my second-ranked goalie overall.
That might be a consensus.
I also have him as the second ranked goalie, and I have Alex Ross as the 21st ranked player.
The two guys defensively that I think are, I mean, we just have to do a story about why they're so good and what the impact they make are. They're very similar in terms of their roles and their programs, but Richard Checo from Lehigh and Max Yates from Colgate. Yates was you know, so Checo has a year head start in terms of the production. They both are, you know, trying to get the Roy Meyer, yeah, that's close, mantle of just uber productive from cause turnovers and ground ball standpoint, mantle in the Patriot League. And I think those two guys are tremendously equipped to do so, especially because of the role that they play in their ride. I saw Lehigh in the fall and Checo didn't play, but I heard through the grapevine that Yates played well for Colgate in their fall scrimmages.
It was an interesting evolution of Checo, more so playing close defense, I believe, as a sophomore compared to primarily as their top LSM as a rookie. And when you look at LSM's guy we haven't mentioned yet is someone I think has garnered perhaps the most attention this offseason in Ben Weyer. We've heaped some praise on him for his fall ball showing that you went to, Matt. 99 ground balls just kind of pops out right away when you look at the stats. And it's incredible. Like, that is just very gaudy. He does not leave the field. 27 calls turnovers, 13 points, 7 goals. Just an all-around great player in transition. I have him in that 15 to 20 range.
Yeah, I mean, he might break the goals record for a long pole this year. I think he's, you know, obviously it's coupled with Virginia's style that they play and that they want him to do that. You know, there is no such thing as a yellow or red light for him when he has.
Is that what, single season record?
The single season scoring record. I think he's, you know, he's going to have a 20 goal season. I know that sounds crazy, but like, I think it's legitimately possible for him.
That offense might need it too.
Yeah, they might need it. They're going to allow him to do that. And like you said, he does not leave the field. You know, he'll be out there. He has a motor like unlike any player I've seen. I had him at, what did I have him? Number 16 on my list. And I kind of messed with that. I think I had him as high as 11 in one draft, and I kind of kept reordering things on that.
Mm-hmm.
But I love Ben Weyer. He's one of the most interesting and exciting players heading into this season for sure.
The knock on him maybe sometimes he's...
I likely fall among us probably the farthest on the opposite spectrum, just under the criticism of like... I mean, yes, he's incredibly disruptive and has so much impact on every game. So like, he is absolutely on this list and it belongs there. But of the, you know, group of us, I'm going to be more critical for like the just hunkering down and playing defense in the most pivotal moments.
We haven't mentioned a team that we had in our top five of the way ahead top 20 rankings: University of Maryland. Just throwing it out there, you know, I think we've all kind of been in agreement that, you know, betting on Maryland is a bet on consistency. That, you know, personnel to some extent is kind of, you know they're going to get the most out of what they get. So just throwing that out there, who had someone from Maryland on their list and who wasn't?
I did.
I had one, but.
I had Logan McNaney at 26. This reminds me of, I can't remember whether it was 2011, 12, or 13, but I did. For a web feature, it was during the season, like a top five players at each position or something along those lines, or maybe it was unit rankings, and Maryland wasn't in the top five for attack, midfield, or close defense, but they were, I think, like number one for like face-off. It was, I can't remember which face-off guy
it
would have been.
I think it was Nico Amato was
the goalie. Nico Amato was number one goalie, yeah. And then Jesse Bernard was the number one LSM. So the point is that they're no stranger to effectively success by committee at particular position groups. And I think, you know, having spent some time with Ajax Zapatello this past weekend, Ajax Zapatello is not on this team, right? He was the number one defenseman in college lacrosse last year. So, like, is Colin Berlitz in a position to take over that mantle? I don't know, maybe, but in terms of top 50 players heading into the season, I would say I'm going to wait and see. So many of their offensive contributors might be these incoming transfers, right? Are we talking about Matthew Keegan as one of their best offensive players at the end of the season? Maybe. If he were coming back to Binghamton, he would have been probably between 51 and 100. So does the fact that he's at Maryland like automatically qualify him for that spot? And then as far as their attack is concerned, you know, between Braden Erksa, Eric Spanos, and Daniel Kelly, who were the starting attack when I saw them in the fall, all known quantities, all good players that can fill a role. I'm not going to make an argument for any of them being top 50. So, you know, even McNaney, like, I think he finished outside of the top 20 in save percentage last year at a hair over 50%. Like, he's getting a bump on the basis of what we know he can do, but just on the straight up and down consideration of save percentage, I don't think he would even belong in this conversation either.
46th in save percentage last season, so a little bit of an off year by his standards. He set some really high standards with the
we know he can be the most outstanding
player, of course, yeah, in that NCAA tournament and that historically great undefeated team. So you can't really bet against McNaney, but right now I think if you put him in that 45 to 50 range, I think that's a good spot for him.
Yeah, I had him at 45, and I did have Jack Dowd as my number 50 player on this list.
Shout out D3 Nation.
Yeah. Hey. Kaplan, where are you at with that one?
He's not on my list. Considered, but
you're turning, your back on your D3, right?
I am. Just as I did last year with Jack Boyden, who also didn't make the top 50 list.
And the way the season went out, or turned out, that was the right call. Who was your Maryland player on the list?
I have Braden Erksa. And McEnany was close. Again, just it would have been a big bump off of what we know he can do based off of that 22 season, yeah. Right? And maybe he's just different post-injury. Like, we don't know. Mm-hmm. But if he has, you know, a great season this year, then he'll be back into the list by the end of it, right? And has plenty of opportunity to play himself into that position. And then Erksa, I convinced myself based on this fall, and just felt like the way he was moving, drawing slides, and distributing warranted that selection. And he's pretty deep in the list. So.
Here's I think we've gotten through most of the top 20 players that we have on our list, minus maybe, you know, one or two here and there. I want to go around to each of you and give me two players that you have on your list that, you know, that you think are kind of outliers, maybe, you know, we haven't discussed or aren't as discussed as some other guys. So, Kevin, I'll start with you.
Well, yeah, I'll keep it in the Big Ten with Matt Collison. Was a player I had really high on my list because of the, whether it was the behind-the-back, one-handed assist of the year against Lehigh or the four or five overtime game winners, he just seemed like a guy who can kind of take over a game or just bring out flashy plays and creativity whenever he wanted. He really didn't put up that great of numbers, but pretty solid in terms of midfield production that we were talking about earlier. And the other guy is Ryan Cohen. 71 points, led the Michigan Wolverines last season. He's going to step into an even bigger role now that Michael Boehm is gone to graduation.
Where do you have him on your list, Buck?
I have him 34th.
I want to break your rule and talk about three guys.
Okay.
But two of them are face-off guys, so they kind of each count as a half a player. Well, they're not on the field very much. So the first guy is the guy who is arguably the most famous player in college lacrosse outside of the world of college lacrosse, which is Jordan Faison.
Mm-hmm.
So where's he going to fit in? I think it's a very reasonable question. When you look at the amount of talent coming back for Notre Dame, this is going to be a hot take, but I don't think it's assured that he's going to be a first-line midfielder. Can a second-line midfielder be a top 50 player in the country? That's an open question.
Only on Notre Dame.
But I had him at 37. With respect to the face-off guys, I had Machado Rodriguez at number 22 overall. He was leading the country in faceoff percentage before he got hurt. I mean, he was over 70% for a good portion of the season, and I think he warrants a look. I think one of the very valuable aspects of this exercise is being mindful of the guys who missed last year,
mm-hmm.
and you know, not necessarily assuming a return at full production based on a return to health, depending on what the injury is that they're recovering from, but also not forgetting about them because they probably weren't All-Americans, and using last year's All-American list and just reordering it based on the guys who we know are good.
Yeah. Right.
And he was great in that football scrimmage. Do you have him above Will Lynch Your face-off years?
If ostensibly, no. They are right next to each other. Mm. The other face-off guy who may or may not end up staying in the top 50, because right now I have him at 45, and there might be a few guys that I didn't have ahead of him that, you know, came up in this conversation that I start to turn around to, but it's Andrew McMeekin, who wouldn't be there on the basis of his face-off win percentage, but one of the metrics that I've touted and love is fantasy point production per game, because the way incorporates all of the aspects of a contribution, right? Not committing turnovers, picking up ground balls, and producing offense. And he was number one in that metric among face-off guys last year. So, you know, I do think face-off win percentage is the best indicator. It's a very good stat. It's not, it's a flawed stat, but it's a very good stat. But I also think that a more holistic approach to evaluating face-off guys is warranted at times as well.
I'm going to break my own rule too and talk about more than two players. So
I also picked three guys.
We're come back to me.
Yeah, exactly. Kevin, you get the kicker.
Yeah, I get one.
Take
more.
Us home.
We're not good at setting limits.
We say this every year, though. We want to go to 100.
Yeah. We could very easily go to 100, and I think the 100th best player, you know, we would still have some serious takes.
It would get heated.
Discussion on. So just talk about guys who, you know, we haven't mentioned, and I think maybe a little bit off the record, not off the record, off the radar. Ryan Bell at Providence, Big East Offensive Player of the Year last year. You know, I think he's someone who's in consideration in that 40 to 50 range. Silas Richmond at Albany, just a guy that can score a ton of creative goals. You know, I know obviously this is a Big Ten, ACC kind of heavy, Ivy League heavy list, but, you know, he's, I think, maybe the best offensive force in the America East. And then when you talk about players returning from injury, remember Bobby Van Buren was, you know, for Ohio State, he was hurt most of last year. So we didn't really get the true look at what he can do. And Ohio State has a lot of just really talented defensive players on that team. So I'm curious to see just, you know, where he falls in the list this year. Obviously, you know, team success, if Ohio State has a little more team success, he'll be more in that conversation. But he, you know, he's an incredible talent that, you know, I think, you know, at times in his career, we'd probably be talking about him in the top 25. Mm-hmm. But I have him around 44 right now on my list. Dan?
All right, so my three guys, and all three of these guys are on my list. Cody Malowski from Denver really turned on at the end of the year in situations where J.J. Solstrap got keyed on Malowski, like, more than rose to the occasion. He's one that I think at the end of the year we could be looking at, like, had 65 points and shouldered a ton of the load for Denver.
Yeah, it's a great shout.
Owen Hiltz, we didn't talk about him. Obviously, like, he has certain flaws to his game, but the pros of his game are just so incredible that he's pretty undeniable on that lefty wing. Great shooter, great feeder, incredible for the balance of that offense, and just does a ton for them. And then the last of those guys, and this is another team that, in general, and especially on the offensive side of the ball, is typically pretty happy with success by committee, and that's Penn State, but I have Matt Traynor. And so he's another that we could see take a real step forward, and him alongside Kyle Lehman, and those two guys are likely going to carry you know, a lot of the load for Penn State, and so I have Traynor on my list as well.
I like that.
For kicker, just one of my favorite stories from last season was the breakout of Georgetown's Aiden Carroll. He's a guy who just plays all out, 100%, 110% really, every game. He played sparingly, scout team guy, rose up the ranks, 37 goals, 23 assists, 60 points. That's a phenomenal season, and he was crucial down the stretch for them to win the AQ and get into that postseason there. So he's just a guy. He was named captain in the fall. It's just full-out hustle, full-out going to – may not be the most skilled offensive player, but what he lacks in skill, he brings with intensity and just ferocious overhand shots with both hands. He's awesome.
And before we totally move on from this, two guys that were honorable mention All-Americans last year that were really close with my list, Ryan Donnery, and he's headed to Ohio State, and then Hunter Druin from Colgate. So both of those guys were, like, right on the cusp as well that deserve, you know, to at least be mentioned here.
For sure. Yeah, so I think we have some work to do. Go back and look at our lists, make any edits and changes if we change anyone's mind with these, and we'll tally these up, and this will be running on Inside the Cross after the holiday. And Terry, I'll give you the closing thought. What about this conversation excites you for 2025?
The fact that I'm pretty sure we didn't name a player who is not playing college lacrosse this year. This sport has become so hard to track who is actually involved. The opening comment when we talked about the Way Ahead Top 10 was, this turnover is historic and unprecedented. Basically, two classes graduated after the 2024 season. And what that means is that the unpredictability is going to be higher than ever before. We just spent an hour talking about, I don't know how many names. I mean, definitely more than 50, probably close to 100 guys. And there is no question that if we were to do this again on June 1st, there would be 25, maybe even 50 guys, probably not 50, but probably 25 guys who did not come up in this conversation that warrant real consideration for top 50 just on the 25 season, not even looking ahead to the 26 season. The unpredictability is going to be incredible, and it is going to make it so much fun to watch.
It's going to be a banner year for lacrosse. I can feel it. I'm getting excited. You can follow it all inside lacrosse. Let's rock.
Let's go.
Inside Lacrosse Podcasts, the source of the sport.